Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa of Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio. Archives of the show can be found a week after broadcast at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us with questions or comments, critiques, ideas at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. This week's episode features a conversation with Luca, an anarchist living in the St. Louis area, about the recent and ongoing struggles against the police in Ferguson, Missouri, a suburb where Michael Brown was killed last Saturday, the 9th of August, 2014, in what is sadly not an out-of-the-ordinary circumstance of an African-American male being killed by law enforcement.
Let's talk about Ferguson, Missouri. A black unarmed teen named Michael Brown was shot repeatedly by a white police officer while Brown had his hands in the air. Since then, an angry community has protested, which led to small-scale rioting and looting. To talk about the situation in Ferguson honestly, though, I think we have to talk about it in a broader context. A couple years back, I wrote a piece called On the Morality of Killing Police, which is still posted at SeanSwain.org. I wrote that in response to a good friend of mine being brutally and unnecessarily assaulted by a St. Louis police officer. I argued then that it's a legitimate question to ask whether defense of human life necessitates the proactive and preemptive killing of police. The fact that I wrote that for posting 2 years ago demonstrates that the rampant problem of sadistic and over-aggressive, trigger-happy cops in the St. Louis area is not a new phenomenon. And to revisit my argument from that article, consider, if that cop who committed the most recent shooting had been found shot dead in his police cruiser after I wrote that article, Michael Brown would still be alive. I'm not advocating the killing of police, because you probably can't do that on the air, even if it makes perfect practical sense. And besides, I already did that on my site. All I'm saying is, when it comes to white cops and black teens, increasing the body count of one will lower the body count of the other. Something else I wrote long ago was entitled Justice for Trayvon Martin? It makes this feel like deja vu all over again. Trayvon was killed over a hoodie and a bag of Skittles. Michael Brown over a cigar. In both cases, community leaders called for calm and urged angry communities to be responsible and peaceful. Those so-called community leaders, marched out before the world by the same guns and badges who do the killing, insist that angry crowds should let the proper authorities handle the investigation and that everyone should return to their assigned seats to await some final verdict. That's what so-called community leaders advocated when cops gunned down Amado Diallo in the doorway of his home, shooting him 41 times, including bullets embedded in the soles of his feet, fired after he had already fallen. Or when they gunned down Oscar Grant, cuffed and face down, pleading with cops on behalf of his baby girl at home. Or Malise Green, or Michael Pitkin, or those two young people in Cleveland, where cops fired 187 shots into their car and liquefied them, all because they were poor and their car backfired. The list goes on, like the roles of victims in a concentration camp. Only the concentration camp is the United States. Community leaders advocating calm and advising protesters to be peaceful couldn't be more irresponsible. We know what that leads to. Diffusing an angry community is the guarantee that the situation won't change. Community leaders' words of calm and peace effectively load the bullets into the cops' pistols for the next shooting and the next. Calls for calm and peace are complicity to Michael Brown's murder and to the next one. Calm, peaceful, right. The official talking heads and community leaders once again urge recourse to official processes, investigations and inquiry, and judicial proceeding designed to achieve justice for Michael Brown, justice for a kid shot multiple times with his hands in the air. As if this elusive and foreign concept they call justice can make up for the absence of life. A nation of mass graves covered in justice. Just look at those cops in Ferguson perched atop military combat vehicles, staring down sights of advanced weapons rolling out mechanized hardware against a black community tired of burying their unarmed kids. Call? Peaceful? Are you serious? To make it worse, some misdirected detention, claiming the real problem is a shortage of black cops, that recruitment of blacks to the police force is fixed, as if hiring a token number of desperate poor blacks to participate in the slaughter of other desperate poor blacks somehow makes it better. On orders of President Obama, somewhere in Iraq, on some stupid mountain in the middle of nowhere, some tiny religious group nobody ever heard of is receiving a U.S. airdrop to save them from genocide carried out by evil extremists. So I gotta ask, when is the federal government gonna airdrop weapons to the black community of Ferguson so they can save themselves from the evil extremists carrying out a genocide on them? Parachutes bring hope to Fallujah. We don't find either one in Ferguson. In the absence of parachutes and hope, direct action and rebellion are the only rational response. No justice, no peace. The police. This is anarchist prisoner Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878 Coitsville-Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. We're speaking with Luca, an anarchist in the St. Louis area, about the uprising that's been ongoing in Ferguson, Missouri. Thanks a lot for agreeing to chat.
Yeah, no problem.
So I know it's all over the media and the internet, but can you tell listeners briefly what happened last Saturday in Ferguson, Missouri, and how you heard about it?
Sure. So last Saturday, in the early afternoon, an officer from the Ferguson Police Department shot an unarmed black teenager who was 18 by the name of Mike Brown. He was shot 8 times when he was 35 feet away from the cop car with his hands up. From that point, a lot of people started spilling out of the apartments surrounding the site where he was shot. He was shot in an apartment complex, sort of off a main strip of commerce in Ferguson. It was on the news very quickly, and we have some folks here in our crew who watched the news like hawks, and somebody picked it up and said, hey, this crazy thing's happening, like let's head up. And so on Saturday night, there was more of like a vigil atmosphere around the site of his death, but what that gathering was met with was cops with assault rifles and dogs. And so it immediately set the tone for the following day.
And so that officer has now been identified by the Ferguson Police Department as Darren Wilson, right? But why did it take them a week to release the name of the officer who shot Mike Brown?
Well, besides the obvious point, but trying to like the wall of silence that kind of comes with police. I mean, they're obviously trying to protect him. There is so much anger in Ferguson. I'm sure that now that his name has been released, that he's in some sort of protective custody because there's no way he can go back to living his normal life, maybe now or maybe ever after what happened.
So people gathered in the courtyard like of this apartment complex. Can you talk about what, if anything, happened beforehand? Was it just an issue of like Mike Brown walking away from a cop car, or were there any like witnesses to the initial altercation? Or
it was supposed that he swiped something from a convenience store around the corner, and so when the police were looking for a suspect or looking for him, and now that they've released his name, the police officer's name, now there's all these, they have released a few pictures of him in this convenience store, maybe stealing something, maybe not. And so that's sort of the precursor up to like that small incident, but as a precursor up to this much larger incident of his death.
So, okay, people are gathering around the body. The body's held for like 4 hours just lying there in the courtyard of this apartment complex. Did he live there? Is that the complex where his family lived?
No, it's not. He was on his way to visit his grandmother who lives in that apartment complex.
So what happened? It came up on the news. The police are just sort of hovering. The community's gathering. I'm sure people were super upset, probably contacted the family and got them down there. But how did that situation of like a crime scene escalate into what it became, which seemed to be some like large scale uprising that lasted for days and nights.
So there's several factors that set the scene for what happened. Like I mentioned earlier, they were immediately met, like mourners were immediately met with force, with a militarized police presence at the site of where they were mourning. So immediately they had cops there in a confrontational manner with dogs and assault rifles. And you can't, you know, like especially dogs have such a particularly nasty history within the African-American community. Like it really riles people up. So that's one factor. The other factor is people are angry. You know, in St. Louis City, so Ferguson is a small suburb of St. Louis, right to the north. It's mostly a working class neighborhood. It's in a greater diverse area, but the municipality itself is about, I don't know, 65% black. The police force is almost completely white. In St. Louis City, you have sort of a similar demographic. It's about half and half in St. Louis City with a variety of other ethnicities, but the police force is largely white. They roll like a gang. They roll like a gang more than almost than they do in any other city in this country, and they shoot somebody about once a month. That person is almost always African American. They're almost always male, and they're almost always young. Often they're unarmed. And then there's this separate history of all of these people dying when they're in custody, whether they're in the workhouse or whether they're in just in police custody in the jail from not receiving proper medical attention. Often these people can't breathe, so it's a likely conclusion that they're being restricted and that by the time they remove that force, it's too late. So there's this huge history in the area of people being murdered with no consequence by police forces in the area.
I mean, you're saying it's once a month and that's something I was unaware of. That's incredible. But I remember, I think last year, hearing about a shooting of a black, like at least young adult, by police in a north suburb.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you, I mean, you might be talking about Carrie Ball, because that's something that a lot of the people here have done a lot of work around. Carrie Ball was shot in North St. Louis. He was shot 25 times by the cops when he was fleeing with his arms up.
Wow. When did that happen?
The anniversary of his death was last April. Carryball, Carrie Ball. There's some more information on it on the STLFTP Tumblr site.
Okay, so there's an ongoing, basically, war on the population, mostly African-American population, by white police officers who I imagine don't live in the city, or don't live in the suburb of Ferguson, but probably come in from out in the country.
You know, I don't think that's necessarily true. Like, in St. Louis City, there is a restriction that if you are a St. Louis City officer, you have to live in the city limit. So then there, it's created these enclaves where a lot of police officers live in generally in white neighborhoods way off, you know, and tucked away in different parts of the city. I don't think that is necessarily the case with Ferguson, but I don't know. I think that the idea behind that philosophy, at least in St. Louis, is that it puts people in greater contact with the people they're policing, mm-hmm. but it's just not true because it's a very segregated city.
Yeah, if they can put a wall around the area that they're living in and just live with a bunch of other cops, it's still that blue wall that separates them from the rest of the community, which is like, that's fine. I don't want to live next to cops.
Right, but right.
Can you give like a narrative of how it moved from people gathered
Saturday to Sunday?
Yeah, yeah.
So on Sunday there was a call for a candlelight vigil at the site of his death in the apartment complex, and there were just so many people that attended. There was over 1,000, maybe closer to 2,000 people that showed up to attend this vigil, and it quickly spilled out into the main strip. I mean, that vigil was also met with a large police presence. And as it was spilling out onto this main strip of commerce in Ferguson, it was met with more police. They had amassed quite a large population of officers from the county force and from different municipalities around St. Louis County. And they quickly cordoned off an area about a mile strip with riot cops on both ends. And so they had set a perimeter, but there were, as people were spilling out of the apartment complex, there were cops that had to get from one end of the strip to the other, and they did drive through this crowd, and immediately they started, you know, people were like kicking and punching and blocking the police cars and opening the doors. And so that's one of the very first things that happened as this quote-unquote candlelight vigil was getting underway. So they set this perimeter. There were standoffs on both ends with these lines of riot cops, but also just eventually in this strip of commerce that things started to pop off.
There was a narrative that was up on Anarchist News about one person's interaction with the anti-police activities that were going on in Ferguson starting on Sunday, I believe. And that narrative included some folks showing up and bringing a sound system. I don't know if that was at the, like, immediately, like, when the vigil was happening or if that was at a later time.
There was never really, I mean, there were mourners gathered at the site all day on Sunday, but there was never really a vigil. I mean, or there was a vigil, like, in that there were mourners there all day, but as far as there being an official event, like, it quickly became something else. So sorry, you were talking about the sound card.
Oh, it's okay. So there's this image, like, that was put into my mind of, like, people showing up and wanting to offer solidarity in their own way, and maybe not being from the community that was actually mourning, like, kind of coming in as people who feel a sense of solidarity and a common cause of hating the police, because the police take people's lives all the time, and they're police. And so coming in from another part of the city and becoming a part of this, like, wider action that was already boiling over at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, like, that's a narrative that often, if you spin it a different way, it gets presented as, and I'm going to make an assumption, but this is at least, like, how when Oscar Grant got killed in the Bay, like, it was proposed that when things started popping off, when things started happening and people started fighting with the police or destroying property, that it was the fault of, like, outside white anarchist agitators from the suburbs that were coming in. But it's like, is that, like, do you feel that that narrative has been placed on this circumstance, and do you feel like it sticks, or is it more complex than that?
There is a very small amount of that narrative coming from a very small group of people, but I generally don't think it sticks. I think that even, like, there's even been small snippets of it in the media, like the mayor has said those things. I think they're largely actually using more like as like little a anarchists, like when people call what's happening, like, this is anarchy, not necessarily like big A anarchist agitators. But there has been some minor accusations of that that happened a little bit later. But I don't necessarily want that to detract from what happened. Actually, some of that has been resolved with the people who were making those accusations face to face.
I think that argument that comes up, and I feel weird even addressing it, is like it takes agency out of the hands of
color. And that's something that I said yesterday, you know, and I was like, when I was talking to Doug, but I was like, this is an absurd idea, because the idea that was about us, that we somehow had any agency over that situation or any ability to incite anything, when we really are just coming to participate in any way that is possible in the moment. That's how we have been, we have been really entering that situation here is, you know, we're thrilled in a lot of ways. I'm thrilled. I think many of us are thrilled to be in a situation where we don't have agency, where we're not creating the situation. We're not swaying it in any specific way. It's just happening in this really beautiful, visceral way where people are expressing their rage, and we have gotten to participate in it with our own. And that is really refreshing, and it's really exciting. And I agree that it's an affront to people to say that we are the instigators of this. And it's an affront, and it's like almost like a vestige of, it's both political and it's like a vestige of white power thinking to think that a small group of white people can go into a black community and like incite their rage. And it takes all of that power and agency away from them. It like devalidates all of their anger when they are acting from a genuine place of their own rage.
See, do you feel that you have the same motivations at this point in participation as when you began to join the struggle against the police in Ferguson? And what sort of relationships have you developed with folks there?
I think that the motivations may have changed on a certain level, in that now it's just, I don't know. I think that a lot of us, myself included, have entered the situation just with being like, hey, this is, like, it might get crazy. Maybe this is the time that it gets crazy. Maybe this is the time that the cops killed somebody, that people finally have had enough, and being present for that. And that's still largely how people are interacting with the situation, just by being present for whatever is happening. And as far as relationships go, like generally people are really positive. It's, you know, have had a lot of like just casual conversations or like bonding over like the cops or we want to protect our kids or all of this shit sucks or just like bonding over these basic tenets of life under capitalism and life under a police state will bring if you are negatively affected by it. So people are more than not like happy to see even people who are probably outsiders and don't live there. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that any of us have created very long-lasting relationships, but we started to see like some of the same faces every day, and it's exciting, and people generally are pretty positive. In the most beautiful moments, it's people stripped away to their basic humanity, because it would be a farce to say that this isn't about race. It's about race, but it doesn't necessarily have to be about race in face-to-face interactions with people around us. Like, we can all recognize it's about race without making it about race in the moment.
You saying that makes me think of, I was reading up a little bit before I went to work yesterday on Anonymous and Op Ferguson, which has a whole bunch of different elements to it. But so Anonymous activists, hacker activists, they put a call out after Mike Brown was killed, saying that because the chief of police would not release the name of the officer, that they would, or they have already infiltrated the police chief's home computer network, the city computer network, the police department's computer network, and would be releasing the name of that officer when they felt that the time had come, or when they could verify it, basically. And among the hacking that they did, there is the claim that one of the things that they hacked was the police chief's home computers, and because he's got cameras on his computers and doesn't think that anyone would ever possibly hack his computer, there's a photo that purports to be from the living room of his house and shows his 20-something-year-old son jumping over the couch in it or whatever. But clearly visible in the background is the bottom of a Confederate flag.
Huh.
Have you seen that photo?
I have not seen that photo. I've also been not, when I'm on the internet, we're mostly, I'm like working on legal support for all the people who are arrested.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen a lot of the probably amazing footage about what's going on. That's not surprising.
So it escalated that first Sunday and went into the wee hours of the morning. Can you talk about how people escalated, what got attacked that night, and also how police escalated their own upping the ante or whatever?
So on Sunday, the two first targets were a QT and a local like meat market and liquor store, because it was unclear which one had called the cops, or supposedly called the cops on this young kid. It started just sort of slowly, and before, like, you know, like people started to throw rocks at the windows, and then people started to like venture inside, and then within a short while, it was a full-blown mayhem. The QT was open, the meat market and liquor store wasn't, and the graffiti started going up about like snitching and avenge Mike Brown and fuck the police. So QT and this meat market liquor store got looted, which also did provide an atmosphere. I mean, it also meant that there was all of a sudden a lot of liquor and a lot of beer. And so people were drinking. In some ways, it was a festive environment. You know, people were pissed, but they're also like, you know, using their vengeance, using their anger to do something. From there, it spread up the street and, you know, to the windows of like tax preparation places, which prey on the poor, got broken. You know, the office of an insurance company, beauty supply stores, people were looting all this weave. You know, there was a 10-year-old girl I saw walk by who had a mask on and a bag full of food and was like, we're going to eat so good at school tomorrow. You know, like people were getting the things, some of the things that they wanted or that they needed. There was a few auto supply stores, just place that sold rims, got its windows broken and stuff looted. Eventually, after a couple hours, they started to move a line of riot cops down the street and largely cleared the area. So after a few hours of people drinking, breaking, looting, graffiti writing, they did eventually push riot cops down the street and largely cleared the area. During that last bit of mayhem, the QT got lit. So the QT burned, but it burned again at that point. But by the time it was a full-blown fire, they pushed everybody out the perimeter. So you could only see the QT on fire from afar. And then during that time, when they were holding this perimeter and when the QT was burning places around there outside the perimeter, they were holding this line on a one-mile strip, largely banking on either side of this one-mile strip, larger shopping centers. So they were clearly protecting commerce, clearly afraid that this was going to spill over into these much larger shopping centers. And some of it did at that point. Some of the, like, Foot Locker, Walgreens, Walmart, like, liquor stores started to get looted outside that area. It took them about 3 or 4 hours, despite the fact that they called in all these other police officers from local municipalities, it took them several hours to bring in even more. And so by the time that the QT's on fire and they've largely cleared the area, that's when they've brought in the city SWAT teams and more riot cops, probably most off-duty cops at the time from the city of St. Louis were called in.
And how many people were those police facing off with at that point? Like how, I mean, I expect a head count. Can you give me a head count? No.
Right.
But like...
over 1,000. Populations petered out as the night went on and, you know, more and more police presence was known. But over 1,000, maybe 1,500.
The part that alcohol plays into it, or like having read some histories of riots in different cities and in different eras and in different countries, it seems like riots in a lot of cases most successful and lead to insurrections most frequently when there's looting of liquor and looting of guns.
Right.
So, I mean, that's how it works.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So it was mostly quelled that night and quieted down. The next day, people decide to gather at the QT, right?
Right. So the QT has become a gathering spot. People aren't going, you know, the police station in Ferguson is about 2 or 3 miles, maybe more. It's quite a ways from this site. It's on the other side of town. It's in the historic part of town that has the coffee shop and the bike shop, and it's quaint and has brick buildings. And this is a couple miles. This area where all this is going on is a couple miles from that place. And so people are using this QT, this burned out QT, as a gathering spot every day. People go to the QT there. People go probably at the QT 24 hours a day. So the next day, yeah, people gather back at the QT and are, again, like, there's just at this point a highly militarized presence. I mean, there sort of always has been, but it's very established now. There are SWAT teams parked up the street from the QT, so armored vehicles with machine guns mounted on them with cops that look like soldiers. They're soldiers just hanging out in them and around them waiting for people to gather. So every night has been met with this force of people gathering, and people started to push back more and more. So by late Tuesday, there's pictures of people throwing Molotov cocktails back because the situation is like a war.
Yeah, that's exactly the adjective that a lot of media outlets have used to describe some of the footage that they've seen and they've gotten a hold of from Ferguson. Has it been just contained within Ferguson of people who have, like, felt the taste of fire from the death of Michael, and then also the police reaction, just feeling it? And like, would you say there's like a sense of, or there has been like a sense of anger and rage and frustration, but also is there any element of feeling of liberation by repeatedly taking the streets with their neighbors?
So media might be using this term that it's a war and I understand that in national media now they're kind of looking at the fact that the police forces are so militarized. We gave these departments all this after 9/11, or even really after the riots in the 60s and 70s and the uprisings in the 60s and 70s, the police departments across the country got highly militarized. But, oh, like, we gave, after 9/11, we gave all these police departments all this equipment, and maybe we shouldn't have. Maybe we need to reconsider that. But so it's being used in the media, but it's also really being used on the ground. It's being used by people that you talk to, that, like, this is a war, we're not going away, like, this is a war zone, this is, like, a war over our lives. And that's the language people are using in the streets.
Yeah, the whole, like, methodology of distributing and militarizing, like, the whole creation of SWAT teams, especially in little towns, the use of helicopters, the armored personnel carriers, like, it's all part of a larger strategy that's been developing for a long time of counterinsurgency. So it really is.
Right.
It is a war, and most people just don't realize it.
More with Luca about the struggle in Ferguson against the police after this musical break.
Charbel, Amadou Diallo, Ayanna Stanley Jones, Oscar Grant. Fire on the streets, I could feel the smoke and the heat. The whole city on lock, got nowhere to eat. A shot heard around the town, so the people won't sleep. Another brother taken down by the fucking police. And we sick of just yelling, no justice, no peace. Deja vu, 1992, pause and repeat. All the tension been building, it's gotten to a peak. It's a Molotov party and we brought our own drinks. But wait, do this really sound silly to ask? How do I explain turning my own city to ash? Is it really just the pigs? Is it bigger than that? Bigger than the gap that he has stuck in his back? Who do they really protect? Is it us or the banks? Same bullet, same tank used on the West Bank. There ain't enough lighters or gas to spray paint. We ran out of methods to express our angst. So let the burden come, murder a man, slaughter. Neither one won't do justice for my man Oscar. Won't do justice for his parents or his little daughter. Tear gas, rubber bullets, more city dollars. Less money for city college or healthcare. More people unemployed, no welfare. The same people on the streets trying to get theirs. Politicians, corporations like hell yeah.
We are not afraid, we are mad. Take it to the streets just like that. It's bigger than the block we on. All power to the masses, home. Bottom to the top, school up. Link it all from that money getting cut up. Meet me at the Fruitvale bar. Shake the system, rip the setup apart.
All we doing is protesting, baby. All we want to do is have justice. So now they want to gas us. Now they want to shoot us. Now they want to beat us down because we're out here protesting against them.
Be on a cell phone camera. Take away the taser. Close the train door. Lay him on the floor. Anger in the land of the raider. Lay a man who would later turn martyr. He's a father to a daughter. Oscar. Same fate shared as I'ma do with Sean Bill. Same fate shared in third world packed jails to protect the haves from the have-nots. And the banks and police is really serving and protecting. No thanks, military police. Protect American peace. You can't see it, but quotations put around the word peace. From a pig in Oakland to a life getting stolen. From a pig in Gaza to the pigs who killed Diana. Yeah, the issue's bigger than one murderous cop. It's Arizona to Watts, Philippines to Iraq. To know the role of police is not to maintain peace, but to keep that big money safe. History's deep.
We're back to our conversation with Luca, an anarchist in the St. Louis area, about the ongoing struggles against law enforcement in the area of Ferguson and greater St. Louis, Missouri, in response to the police murder of unarmed black male Michael Brown.
So one of the things that happened by Monday, there was some looting in other parts of the city, and at that point, the energy level and the fear, it seemed, among city officials and police departments around the area was really high. So they shut down the main mall after there was a fist fight because they were afraid of looting. They had cops all over the Del Mar Loop. They had cops all over the Central West End. The Loop is a neighborhood in St. Louis. Like, it's a shopping district and a lot of cafes, and it's one of the only places where, like, a lot of kids gather. A lot of kids hang out, like young teenagers hang out in the Loop. And so they had cops all over the Loop by Monday. They had cops all over the Central West End, which is a really wealthy part of town, and copters, like, in both places. And so by Monday night, the fear had spread, at least by people making decisions to other parts of the city. Still after that, after Monday, has still largely been contained in Ferguson. There has been a vigil. There was a vigil last night that I didn't attend because I was in Ferguson in downtown St. Louis that Michael Brown's mother came to. And I hear it was a very profound experience where these people, like, where hundreds of people stood with her and cried and sobbed with her for her son. And that had a breakaway march from it of a couple hundred people, but it didn't really necessarily come of anything except that they marched around the city.
You've mentioned a few things that the police have been doing, and we kind of talked about militarization of police. And you mentioned Molotovs, but can you talk about what sort of tactics and what sort of after Monday night, I guess, when they tried to, like, close off either end of the street and keep people from entering other shopping centers. Can you talk about, like, what kind of tactics and what kind of weaponry the police have been deploying in Ferguson?
They've been using tear gas every night since Monday. They didn't use tear gas on Sunday. They didn't use non-lethal weapons. They didn't use pepper spray or pepper balls. They used just this, like, physical force or then their presence to drive people back. But since Monday, there's been tear gas deployed most nights, pepper balls, but little wooden batons.
And those are shot from shotguns, right?
Right, and those are shot from shotguns. And so those are the things they're using to try to disperse crowds. The flip side of all of this is there are so many people now who have the experience of putting on a mask. Like, that's one of the things I was thinking about last night when I was there. And there's so many people in masks, and how powerful my first experience, like a long, long time ago, of putting a mask on, like how powerful you feel. And I was just thinking, like, there's all of these people who now have that experience, especially young people who like put on a mask for the first time.
That narrative that went up on A-News sort of talked about how, at least from the author's perspective, a lot of people didn't want to put on masks because of a sense of pride of like, no, like, I'm fine with people knowing that I'm doing this because it's badass that I'm doing this.
That was that night. And I think just watching it change, and how by last night, even in the face of a very different policing strategy, how we're on Sunday, almost no one had masks on, you know, people, some were taking off their t-shirts and wrapping them around their faces. But nobody came prepared, you know, and so to like watch that change over the course of the days has been really amazing too, to like watch people be like, oh, these are the things we can do to protect ourselves, or these are the ways we can like fight back, which is like a little bit of awareness and preparation.
So you mentioned policing strategies changing. Can you talk about the governor's action of yesterday and what happened with that?
Right. So it almost seems like they've brought in, I would venture to say that they probably brought in consultants. Somebody got very smart, very fast about how poorly the situation was being handled. They have not pulled all of the militarized police out of the area. There are definitely still some of that presence and resources present in a staging area in Ferguson, but they replaced the goons from the county with state troopers, with the idea being that it would help de-escalate the situation by bringing in an outside force that theoretically had it more together because it was from the state. And they put a African-American captain into more or less like the chief of command over these operations, and have pulled out on the ground, like as far as boots on the ground, all of the riot police. And so now that it was night and day, that happened yesterday, and as there was a coalition of African American churches that organized a legal rally in March, starting at the QT and going to this church and coming back yesterday. And the new captain, his chief of operations, came and marched with them. And he, you know, even, you know, he made a statement, he talked and was like, you know, I'm a black man with black sons. I have like a dog in this fight. And it did change everything. You know, so last night what happened is, instead of a street battle, it was this, I would almost venture to say, like, festive street party for about a mile, the same strip that was looted and riot, you know, looted and burned the other night. And it almost, at first glance, could have been a concession. There were thousands of people there hanging out, driving up and down the street, honking their horns. It was a real street party atmosphere. People were cruising, playing music really loud, like lots and lots and lots of kids like hanging in cars, on cars. And one of the things that was going on, there was literally almost no police there. I saw five cops on the ground on foot. They walked in. They did not bring their cars. So it was the captain. It was the chief of police for Ferguson and like a general, like a few extra cops for security. And they walked through the crowd. And I mean, I'm telling you that the chief of police for Ferguson was sweating bullets the entire time. He looked so freaked out, and he was moving at a fast clip, but would stop and talk to people sometimes. And so another thing that was happening was the new Black Panther Party and the Nation of Islam were running security. So they were keeping people out of the streets. They were keeping traffic open on that street. And they had literally aligned themselves. Not only were they acting as cops, but they had aligned themselves with cops with the idea, like I heard one of them say, quote unquote, like, we're keeping our own house clean tonight. So at first glance, that like that really seems like a concession. Like they just, you know, conceded the area to people.
You mean like, the residents have?
No, I guess I mean like, oh, like the police, like it looks like the police just ceded that area for the night. They're like, all right, fine, take it, like let off steam, like we're going to back off. You know, but the reality of what happened, there were two times last night where they brought in vehicles, police vehicles. And the minute they brought vehicles in, they were surrounded and banged on and kicked at. And they left so fast. So the first instance was there was a girl who I think had fallen out of a truck. And for some reason, the police came in to get her and not EMT. And it didn't make any sense because they carried this person who was unconscious and picked her up. And that's clearly not how you provide aid to somebody who's fallen and has potentially a head injury. But they either way, so cops came in and took her out like as quickly as actually possible. And then around 1 a.m, there was a report of a possible attempted burglary at the McDonald's on that strip. And so 7 or so state trooper cars came in. 5 of them went into the McDonald's while the rest of them stood around and protected the cars. And I would say they were in that McDonald's for less than a minute before they came out and they all fled. And as they fled, like, people are mobbing them. Like, I've never seen cops get mobbed out so fast. They're just like pushing and beating. It's like surrounded. Like, so at first it seems like, oh, fine, like you can just have this area for the night. But like the reality is that if they come into that area with vehicles, it is adversarial. People see it as a fight. And people immediately start to push back against their presence.
Wasn't there another officer-involved shooting that happened immediately after Michael was shot?
You know, people have guns. There were shooting the night, you know, there's shooting the night of the riots. There's been shooting at helicopters, at the police helicopters throughout this whole ordeal. And I don't know the exact details of it, but there was some sort of shootout with the cops, I believe, on Monday. And maybe Tuesday. It's all murky at this point. The days are running together. Anyway, and they did shoot someone else in this sort of shootout.
So that was people engaging with guns with law enforcement?
Yes. So there hasn't necessarily been a lot of backlash about that particular instance. And that man is in critical condition, but he is alive.
Yeah, that's interesting. Just that, like, people consider the presence of vehicles. I mean, I guess, like, when a cop's in a vehicle, they're kind of incapacitated to a degree, like in terms of like throwing elbows or what have you, although they could put a gun up to the glass if they wanted to.
Right.
Now that the state troopers have been in control and a day has passed almost since that's happened, how have the people that you've talked to from Ferguson, like, how have they seemed?
I mean, I think on a certain level, you know, it depends on who you are. Like, some people welcome the calm. If some people want it to, you know, to have these quote-unquote, like, proper channels get back to work, the investigation to really start, the trial to get underway if this officer is going to be charged and have these, like, creaky wheels of injustice start to turn. I think that people, I don't know, I can't tell if people are just glad that they're gone or see it as a triumph that it's changed so drastically. Or what? But I mean, people are already back at the QT this morning, or maybe even never left from last night.
As you pointed out, it's tiring. Like, you, for one, haven't gotten much sleep over the last few days, and I imagine a lot of people in those communities haven't either. It's also interesting to, I mean, not surprising, I guess, like, because what I know of them is, like, having Black Panther friends myself, like, people who were in the party at various locations and at various times, the new Black Panther Party and the Nation of Islam kind of acting as this like proto-state formation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really surprise me, but it's just a little like irksome.
Oh yeah, it's gross. It's awful. It's awful.
There's a bunch of reasons why the Panther Party has distanced itself and like attempted like threatened lawsuit against the members who used to be in that threatened lawsuit against the new Black Panther Party because of their values concerning gender and race and kind of reactionary politics.
Interesting last night, because if it had been a different situation, I think some of us, myself included, like would have gotten up and like would have like yelled about it, you know, but like, that is not the time or place for it in such a racially, you know, in a lot of ways, and still a pretty racially charged atmosphere. But yeah, I think it's still probably a lot of people agree that they're a disgrace to their history.
One thing that seems to have come up a lot, or like an interesting thing around the events in Ferguson, is the role that Alderman Antonio French played in it. Can you talk about that? Like, what's your read on that person? And what is an alderman anyway? I've never grown up around
this. Right, what is an alderman anyway? So the St. Louis City we don't have a city council. There is a board of aldermen, and they represent different districts. And there's, I think there were 19 and now there are 17. It doesn't really matter. Wards in the city, and that's, an alderman is like a city councilman, only they represent districts instead of running for city council from any part of the city and being elected. So that's how that system works. And he is a fairly liberal or progressive alderman from the city of St. Louis who has been really active in the struggle in Ferguson, or at least present for a lot of it, and tweeting and writing about it. And my take on him is he's sort of interesting. He's a politician, but he definitely maybe has seen enough people lose support for acting too much like politicians that he doesn't act too much like a politician.
Tries to walk the line of being a people's man or what have you.
Right, right.
And he was arrested at least once over the last week.
Yeah, he was arrested, I think, on Tuesday night.
He's apparently back out because his Twitter is back up and running.
Oh, yeah, I saw him last night. Yeah, trying to quell people's anger.
Woohoo! Thanks, politician.
Right.
Another element that's been covered by parts of the media is the suppression of media that's occurred, which I imagine will not be quite as much of a thing with the state troopers in there. But,
right.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so there hasn't been a lot of media presence until last night. You know, so now all of a sudden, I mean, and granted, those are their own slow-moving wheels as far as how fast they get people to places, but last night was the first night that there was a lot of media, a lot of national media there. And it was funny to watch some of these kids just, like, eat it up, have all this attention on them and just be loving it, like, mugging for the camera, like, all these crews in masks mugging for cameras, which probably be a lot of interesting footage today of what happened last night.
But in the meantime, like, there may not have been a huge amount of, like, media presence, but I think that could be partially, that's related to the fact that there have been arrests of people in the media or attacks on people in the media.
Oh, sure, right. Police. Like tear gassing Al Jazeera and taking other equipment. You know, that happened.
Or arresting the Huffington Post and I think it was Wall Street Journal folks, like after slamming them like in a McDonald's where they were writing a report for their papers.
Right.
Slamming them up right against the window and then taking them away.
Right. Very hostile situations. You know, they really, I mean, it's an interesting conversation about what causes conflict or what keeps conflict going, you know, but their botched policing of the situation definitely was escalating the situation and somebody finally figured that out.
Yeah. Also related to that, so there was imposed a no-fly zone over the Ferguson, or at least that was announced on Democracy Now! And some other media outlets,
right,
that there would be a no-fly zone. Was that for the purpose of keeping away media coverage, as far as you know, or drones, or like what?
Well, I don't know the exact logic of it. Ferguson is very close to the airport. You know, planes fly over it all the time. And people, you know, with the...
They've
read
rocket launchers, like some nascent.
Well, I mean, like the recent
group
events, like even just like people shooting helicopters. I would say that they were just scared. And I also think on a certain level, like that no fly zone then meant that none, you know, like all of the major television stations in St. Louis have helicopters. And so, yeah, like of course it also keeps out media from being able to fly over and get clear footage of what's happening right below them on the ground.
So last night there was a call out for solidarity actions in other parts of the country and other parts of the world. And there have been calls out anyway in different communities around the world for moments of silence or for actions on behalf of or in solidarity with the people resisting in Ferguson and also in memory of Michael Brown. Have you heard much about that stuff? And have you heard folks down at the QT talking about that at all? Like, do they hear about like, someone did something there, like dropped a banner or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, people know it's happening. I ever heard people like on their, like looking on their phones, looking and be like, oh, there's this thing happening in Little Rock. There's this thing happening in Oakland. There's this thing happening in Detroit. So people are at least a little keyed in, you know, to the fact that there is solidarity demos last night, and I think there's another big call out for tonight. I don't know that much about what's going on in other places at all, but I'm sure I will soon enough.
Were there things that we didn't really talk about that you'd like to talk about?
I think the only thing that I'd like to talk a little bit about, and I could, touch on it yesterday again, was how we here as anarchists are interacting with the situation. And I think I have said before, and I'll say it again, how refreshing it is to just be in a situation and definitely bring an anarchist perspective, like as people who have been anarchists for a long time myself, or to speak for myself, like that's how I moved to the world. I moved to the world as an anarchist. That's the lens, that is the first lens I look at anything through. That's the lens I'm looking at this through. But that I'm going just as a person. I'm being present just as a person who's angry, as a person who, you know, have people I love and I'm part of a community that gets harassed by the police, you know, and how, again, like how refreshing that is to have to go like to not go and be trying to hold quote unquote an anarchist presence, like not taking flags or pamphlets or banners and just going and being just like everybody else who's pissed off, you know, especially, and that became especially clear after watching the RCP come from Chicago and bring their banners and their revolution paper and be handing it out and trying to quote unquote like politicize people in a specific way. Because what's happening on the, like there in Ferguson, like where people are acting from is it's just inherent. It's inherent that you hate the cops. It's inherent that you want to, like, at least on the first night, like shout down the politicians and shout down the preachers who are trying to tell you what to do. So after watching the RCP come in and try to be an entity that had influence over the situation, it made me like all the more glad that we haven't been interacting in a situation with this specific agenda that we're just there, and how like liberating it is to be able to just do whatever is we want to participate in whatever is happening with the current of people around us. Yeah, and there has been certainly some recuperations.
Yeah,
between church coalitions and the NAACP and, you know, Nation of Islam and these organizations for Black struggle talking about Black power and mm-hmm. you know everybody's got their shtick that they want to get in, but. Yeah, I mean, and it was like how quickly the RCP tried to align themselves with people who were policing the crowds yesterday. It was just disgusting. It was just disgusting.
It's so totally telltale, though. Like it just like, yes, this is what you are. You are politicians and future cops. Like that's what you would be.
Right.
Go take your Baba Vakian back. Take it back somewhere else.
Right.
Thanks a lot for chatting, and I really appreciate getting those insights from you.
Yeah, sure. I hope it was. That's helpful.
Definitely.
I still feel struggling for articulation throughout all of this. So. Cool. I was just going to say there is the anti-state stl.noblogs.org site if people want to check out the first-hand accounts of what our crew is writing here and what's coming out of here, and that there is a link on that site for a jail fund. There's been quite a bit of money that's been raised already to try to help people bond out. There are quite a few people with felony charges from Sunday night, and that list of people arrested is growing. So,
can you say anything? Well, you just said like just a ton of people have been arrested, so that's, you don't have any specific numbers. But night by night, it was like there were 30 people arrested on Sunday night, and there were 22 arrested like the next night. So
yeah, you know, they've been employing tactics of force, but not mass arrests. And I would say that in part, that's because the municipality of Ferguson doesn't have the ability to hold that many people. But instead of trying to arrest people, they've mostly been just using force against people. But there were, I think, 32 people arrested on Sunday, and then a slow trickle since then. So I think the number tops out right now around 45, which actually is pretty remarkable that's all the people who've been arrested.
Were there any that people that were specifically arrested in terms of having the Molotov?
Not that I know of.
Good, because that could be a big charge.
Right. Yeah, not that I know of. Okay. I think one of the most exciting things about about uprisings is that what happened and what people participated in now lives in them. And so there are all of these kids, there are all of these people who have had that experience of donning a mask. They've had that experience of breaking a window. They've had that experience of shouting down a police line. They've had that experience of standing up for themselves, and that lives in them. And the way that things become possible, again, is by creating something that lives in the popular imagination. And so now this reaction lives even more strongly in the imaginations of so many people. That's how popular uprisings are built, by having these experiences, these visual experiences, and that now they live in the popular imagination of all of these people.
And may the big one come soon.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the big one comes soon, or maybe that this can help continue to set a precedent that every time the cops kill somebody, this is how people are going to react.
I've made the assumption already, by the way, that we've talked about race, but I'm assuming that you're read as a white person.
Right.
And I think it's good to dialogue, honestly, but also in well thought out manner around how, yeah, we get focused on by law enforcement as anarchists, but it's in a different way than someone who is read. I can walk around and not be read by as an anarchist, but it's pretty hard for someone to walk around and not be read as a young black male or young black female or what have you. But I think the way that you've talked about your experience with engaging with folks in a practical and not in a explicitly political framework, I think is really cool. And I'm really glad that we got to have this conversation.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely right. If you're talking about circles of harassment, there's this bigger circle that we fall under, and then there's fall into. And then there's this much smaller circle that we don't fall into, that is largely African-American youth, African-American men.
Does it look like it's going to be continuing along the same ways? I mean, that tension was still there, but you think the policing strategy has made it so that large masses of people taking the streets and becoming angry when they're confronted by the police, it's probably not going to be what's happening over the coming days?
Probably not. I mean, they have definitely de-escalated the situation. I don't know. I mean, maybe now it's going to be a giant street party, and we'll see how long they let that go on for. It's the weekend now, so we'll see if this giant street party continues and see, so basically being there last night is it's just a giant autonomous zone where we were just in one giant autonomous zone for hours. And it was still this amazing and awesome experience, despite the fact that there was no conflict. It was a very different experience than I've had the rest of the week, but it was just as awesome.
Good.
And people were just happy and clowning and celebrating in this way, this weird way, sort of under the banner of unity, under the banner of probably feeling freer than they had been, because the space no longer has this militarized police presence in it.
It's just at the borders and the boundaries of it, I guess. Well, thanks a lot for chatting.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Asheville Free Media, ashevillefm.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWALP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRSLP out of Columbus, Ohio.